listening to a Drishti Point podcast. Please visit our website for more inspiring interviews on yoga, spirituality, and wellness.
I'm Farah Nasrallah, and I'm here with Lama Surya Das. Lama Surya Das is one of the foremost Western Buddhist meditation teachers and scholars, one of the main interpreters of Tibetan Buddhism in the West, and a leading spokesperson for the emerging American Buddhism. And he's also author of Buddha Standard Time and Awakening the Buddha Within. And we're here with him on the telephone to talk about his book, Buddha Standard Time. Welcome, Lama.
Thank you, Farah, and it's nice to be here in the holy now, which is what Buddha Standard Time refers to, not EST, Eastern Standard Time, or Pak Time, your time, but Buddha Standard Time, the holy and entirely holy and sacred now. But I don't know if we should welcome people to that because we're always in it. So we'll just say, let's enjoy it and savor it and thank, quote, God for the holy now.
Now, it's very interesting that the whole book, you talk about Buddhism as a profound study in time and time management and how our perception of time depends on our own minds and perception of reality. Can you talk a little bit about what it means that our perception of time depends on our own mind?
Rather than waxing philosophical, we're trying to explain Einsteinian time and space and, you know, how time is relative and all that. I think everybody understands that when we're in pain, every minute, every second seems very long. And when we're in pleasure, just to put it grossly, it goes very fast. And that's a good example of how time is so relative or kaleidoscopic. It can be long or short, kind of telescopic, depending on our perception of it. Thus the ancient cliche or saying, the watched pot never boils. Of course it boils eventually, but it feels like never because you're watching it. On the other hand, if you put on the tea kettle and go in the other room, sometimes you forget about it and the whole kettle starts to melt because, the time went so fast while you're out of the room, you just forgot about it. So time is just so relative. It's such a mental construct. Time and space are relative, and really reality is relative, subjective, but that's another whole matter. So in short, I think the whole point of this, my message is that there's plenty of time. It's up to us how we use it and prioritize it, and that we have all the time in the world. It's up to us to how we use it. Actually, there's plenty of time. Life is quite long enough for those who know how to live.
Now, one of the things you come to over and over again in your book is nature and natural rhythms and how we can sync ourselves with the natural rhythms of nature to experience that timeless quality of our lives. Can you talk a little bit about circadian rhythms and nature?
We're so much part of nature, it's hardly worth saying today. You know, when I grew up, a long time before you, I think, people weren't so environmentally aware, although native people and others, of course, were always for a long time. But these days, everybody's much more aware of nature and being part of nature and not just human beings, but all beings, all creatures, and the whole animate and inanimate world. Nature is actually the original form of spirituality before it even evolved into sun gods and goddesses, or for that matter, monotheism and other things in more recent millennia. But the reason I mention this is because nature transports us beyond ourselves. It's so vast and it's so all-encompassing. It's our mother. It's our ground. And it's where we come from and where we return to. And it dwarfs our petty individual preoccupations. And I think that helps us get a perspective on things so we can live very much here and now. And we can plan for the future and so on, but we can very much understand we're not going to be here forever and not just think about ourselves, but other priorities like what kind of world we're leaving to our children and the other generations. And nature is so sacred in that sense because it's our source, it's our mother, it's our God or goddess, really. We're all part of it. And interconnectedness and interbeing, interdependence has become so much part of public consciousness today. I mean, it could be more, but this is not big news now. But 2,600 years ago was when spiritual teachers were talking about this. So this is timeless wisdom, very timely for today and tomorrow, that eternity is in every single instant and the infinite in every bit of finite reality. And that's the crossroads, or that's the great paradise or pure land in which we stand. And I call it being there while getting there every step of the way. That's the spiritual path for me, being there while getting there every step of the way, not waiting, not postponing it after I die until later. Being there means being totally here and now while getting there together, actually, every step of the way. And nature is just so holy and so sacred and such a gift and a miracle. We can't fool ourselves and pretend that we created it or we created ourselves. That's a great reminder to be humble. And that I, you know, me, myself, and I, as I like to call it, the three Jews, aren't really in charge or creator of this universe. And it helps one be humble and also in tune and see that what is in us and what we care about is in others also, that we're all part of nature. Human nature is part of Buddha nature or divine nature. That's also an aspect of nature that I think is very important.
Now, you mentioned in your answer, there was a lot you mentioned, but one of the things that I like in the book, you talk about waiting, the ways that we can use, for example, waiting in line, or if you were in traffic, or if we're on a bus, or if we're, if we are technically in the English language, in between one thing and another. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, smiling is a blessing,
yes,
and the practice of wow, W-O-W?
Wishing others well. Wow. Yes, that's a nice, easy acronym to remember. And it's a great practice. It's really the Buddhist practice of loving kindness, which, I mean, you might as well call it a Christian practice. It's a spiritual practice. It's a very lovey heart practice of wishing others well moment to moment. And a smile, of course, is one of the greatest. It bridges the gap between oneself and other. And it costs us nothing, and it brings so much. I can't emphasize that enough. That's thus the Buddhist saying, the Tibetan Buddhist saying, always cultivate an upbeat mind or a cheerful attitude. Not to be Pollyanna-ish, but just to try to see the positive in things. Not to mention to see the light, the Buddha in everyone and everything, but at least see the positive in things. And even when so-called bad things happen, it may have a silver lining, or, you know, as they say, when a door closes, a window opens somewhere else. So you asked about waiting and waiting online. Amusingly enough, the story in Buddhist Standard Time that people refer to the most, because it's so surprising, is where I advocated the practice of trying to take the longest line at the grocery store. Everybody said, "What, are you crazy? Who does that?" You know, time is money, etc. Our usual thinking. But even just by doing it once, anyway, that story in there, you know, about taking the longest line and just seeing that sometimes it goes just as fast or faster. How much does it really matter? Maybe you meet somebody wonderful on the line while you're standing there, or their wonderful child. You never know. And what are we in such a hurry for anyway? Where do we think we're going? You know, life is not just a to-do list to get through. Meanwhile, it seems to me like we're so stressed out, hurrying and rushing and leaning forward and almost never being where we are, always being where we're trying to get to. So part of the practice of presencing that I advocate, not just meditation, but presencing, awarefulness, mindfulness, if you like, it's such a popular word today, is coming home and being here now while we're getting there, sitting in your car seat and feeling your body, and so while driving to get where you're going, not just projecting outwards to where you're trying to get all the time and overlooking where you are. Because if we're not here now, I guarantee you we won't be there then. And that's the problem. We're always ahead of ourselves, sort of half or mostly out of our body and out of our soul and our energy, out of touch with ourselves and reality. So we're kind of staggering forward on the treadmill of conditioning, under the momentum of our own conditioning, like gerbils on a gerbil wheel, and not really getting anywhere. So sometimes it's amusing to take the longest line or to, you know, let people pass you when you see you're driving crazy and passing everybody. You just get in the right line and watch what the other people do. And then when you see them drive like you did, you say, wow, look at that crazy there. What's wrong with them? And then you realize you were just doing that 3 minutes ago. And try to recondition these habits that we have, always hurrying. Of course, when it's time to hurry, then just hurry. That's fine. But why all the time? And where are we really trying to get anyway? So I think that, you know, these days we seem to live in a speeded up way. But I think there's plenty of time. It's not time we lack, but focus, awareness, and presence of mind and heart. And really, there is enough time. You know, everybody has the same 24 hours. And what's all the rush anyway? I mean, I'm a New Yorker. I have motor mind just like anybody else. But I've also found inner peace through meditation and prayer and awareness and chanting and stuff like that. And I really think if I can do it, you can do it. Anybody can do it. And really find heaven on earth and nirvana right here in worldliness. No problem. That there is inner peace at any speed, at any decibel level in our heart. We can find it. We can live from that, even when we have to hurry.
I'm in the jet stream
as much as anybody with my teaching schedule and retreats around the country and the book tours and media interviews and publications and things like that. I hope our listeners are not naive and think, oh, Lama Suryadas can say that. You know, he doesn't have to work. He just meditates all the time. I mean, I hear people say that. The Dalai Lama can say, be nice to everybody. You know, nobody hates him. Well, go to China and see what they say about the Dalai Lama, please. If you want, what the names they call him and how they think of him. But it doesn't bother him. He has compassion for people's slanderous words about him. Compassion, you know, so it's not what happens to us, but what we make of it that makes all the difference. That's my message. Then we're master, not victim. Master of condition and circumstances. Not control freak, but we have self-mastery. We're not the victim of what happens to us. It's not what happens, but what we make of it. That makes all the difference in our character, in our experience, in our destiny, in our karma, in the word.
Now, you mentioned it earlier, and I think in order to develop mastery, we need to develop focus and concentration. And, you know, can you speak about meditation as one way to develop focus and concentration in the rest of our lives when we're not in a formal practice?
Yes, focus, concentration, and awareness, of course, and developing wisdom and insight and opening our heart and mind. Focus and concentration is just sharpening the tool, and we have to use it, the tool of the mind, awareness, the spiritual consciousness, let's say. And there are so many contemplative traditions. So I'm a Buddhist, I guess. I like to meditate. I've been doing it for 45 years, blah, blah. But, you know, there's also yoga and chanting and Tai Chi and other prayer and other wonderful spiritual disciplines, visualizations and all kinds of things that we could be doing. So it's good to sample these and try to find what fits you yourself, just like to know what kind of food regimen or what kind of exercise program is good for oneself. And have a personal daily spiritual practice or awareness training or something, not just be a joiner and a member of a club, a church, or just sit there on Sunday and think about other things. Try to have a daily spiritual practice because this is about a whole spiritual life. It's about a journey of wakefulness, of awakening, not just a weekend or an event or somebody preaching and us nodding our heads. Nobody can do it all, but no one is exempt from participating. So how are we going to participate in this world? That's why these days I'm saying to the young people, and I've really been turning my attention more to the young people and not just to the gray-haired baby boomers that I know so well, being part of that Woodstock generation, if I can remember, which is questionable. I always say, you know, it's time to occupy the spirit, occupy the Dharma. Don't leave it to the one of the Dalai Lama or whoever your spiritual hero is, to occupy the spirit. But this is not news. Jesus said, usher in the kingdom of heaven. You know, we have to be the ushers, not wait for some Messiah to come. The Messiah is in each of us. Maybe the Messiah is the community today. It's the grassroots, you know, occupy the Messiahship. So I feel like it's very important for us to have a personal spiritual practice. whatever kind that is, and then to take it out of the yoga room or meditation seat, prayer cushion, into daily life, integrating spirit into every nook and cranny of daily life. That's where the rubber really meets the road on the spiritual path in daily life. Otherwise, it's just a fantasy.
Mm-hmm. And how about those times where, inevitably this happens and we face challenges or difficult things arise from within us, difficult emotions, difficult thoughts, and, is it presencing that helps us, that gives us the tools to move through it or overcome it?
Yes, that's exactly the idea. Yes, Farah, that's exactly the idea. Well, you know these things because you're a yogi, et cetera. People are all talking about mindfulness today because it has so many benefits. I call it meditation with benefits. It's a kind of a loving kindness approach to life, wishing others well, including ourselves, of course. Wow, wishing others well, very important. Meditative awareness, mindfulness, presencing, cultivating presence of mind, that's what we're practicing in the meditative traditions so that we are more aware of what comes up in the field of consciousness in the body-mind continuum from outside or from inside or wherever. So we can practice, for example, mindful anger management and healthy emotional processing so that we create some space between the stimulus and the response to choose how, when, and if to respond, not just blindly react. I like that. I'm going to say that again. So we create some space between the stimulus, what happens from outer or from inner, and how we respond, not just blindly react. Mm-hmm. So we create a sacred pause. As my grandmother used to say, Jeffrey, count to 10 before you hit back. So, I could never count to 10, and I was 7 or 8 years old when she imparted that wisdom to me, but it means think before you act. So how we relate to what arises from outside, shit happens, or from inside, we feel things or emotions or reactions or moods or whatever, how we respond to it makes all the difference. And so that's the secret of mindful anger management, not control freakism or suppressing it, but healthy emotional processing. And that's where mindfulness rather than mindlessness comes in. Mindfulness rather than mindlessness, being very present and accounted for. And then we can do a lot better, just like at the wheel. If we're mindless at the wheel, not to mention intoxicated or very distracted and multitasking, if we're mindless at the steering wheel of the car on the road, what happens? And this is not particularly, we're not talking morality or religion here. We're talking about like basic intelligence, basic sanity. Mm-hmm. So mindful is the antidote to mindlessness, to sleepwalking through life and missing our life and our opportunity. And there's nothing better for that than some form of contemplative exercise, let's call it meditation, but it doesn't have to be quiet sitting meditation. It could be chanting meditation, could be walking meditation, could be mindful yoga meditation, Tai Chi movement meditation, and so forth. And by extension, it could be nature meditation, which I've talked about in this book and other books, tuning into the water, fire, wind, air, space. I love doing that. Water is my element. Whenever I see water, like a lake or river, ocean, I just naturally meditate. I don't have to sit down and cross my legs. It's not my legs that are meditating. But the flow, the peace of it, the ripples on the surface, like my thoughts, but the depths unmoved, like sitting on the beach. Why would I close my eyes and try to concentrate on my breathing or on a mantra when the waves and the sound and the wind and the sound of the waves is doing it for me? Just wash everything away with natural meditation. So you can get yourself out of the way and kind of let go and let Buddha do it, as they say. Natural meditation, nature meditation, being transported beyond your finite ego self by the vastness, the beauty and profundity, magic and miracle of nature, of the present moment. Spirituality is not just a lonely path. We could co-meditate together also.
So to be in silence with someone else.
Right. Silence is one way, or take a nature walk, or if you had a silent nature walk. It could be singing or chanting or praying together. It doesn't have to be silent. It could be couples yoga. Could be with a group, not just two people. Could be with your dog. Mm-hmm. You know, relational meditation. Why limit it to people? Why be so square, LBQMB, whatever, five initials? How about doing it with God? How about doing it with Jesus? How about doing it with your pet? You know, communing with them is what I'm talking about. Letting go of yourself in the sacred third, that you and I make sacred third, the country of we. That's what we're talking about. The sacred third beyond the ego. Natural meditation. Really, communion, co-meditation, communion.
So, one of the things that really stuck in my mind in your book when you talk about presencing is that the most miracles you've ever seen have been in the presence of unconditional love, and that when we can commune with another in unconditional love,
yes,
it has a miraculous effect. Can you speak about that?
Well, probably when I said that, I'm thinking of being with my own gurus, perhaps in India, I'll say, but I don't want to make it sound like it's far away. It's just I spent my 20s and 30s over there, so with my Tibetan and Hindu gurus. But, you know, unconditional love also you can experience with your lover or your child, your pet, your loved one, or with God, if you like. I feel that, so many people are mistakenly looking for someone else to complete them, but really, 1 + 1 = oneness. When you can experience more wholeness, then you come to, as a whole person. And there's plenty of room for another in that. You're not fully of yourself. 1 + 1 = oneness, which is the goal, not half plus a half, because somehow those two halves, those two broken pieces, never really fit together exactly, as you know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. The divorce rate. You know, society shows it, but more subtly, just even moment to moment, day to day, you know, coming from wholeness and completeness, cultivating contentment and non-attachment and very, always cultivating an upbeat and open heart and mind, cheerful attitude, like I was saying before, the ultimate is saying. This helps us to really see the best in others and commune with the angels in everyone and in each other. And I'm not talking about airy-fairy angels. I'm talking about the better self, the angelic nature, the inner child, the little Buddha inside each and every one of us, the inner divinity. And the more we cultivate a kind of present awareness, you know, presence, awareness is a verb. I like to talk about awaring or awareful. You know, it's really not just sitting and meditating, but being aware of your breathing and your words and your implications and trying to empathize and feel what others are feeling in a moment. That's like a co-meditation, communion. Mm-hmm. Feeling what others are feeling. When you feel with them, your heart quivers. When with their quivering, you get, it's like tuning forks resonating together. That's the root of compassion. Then you feel their pain and you naturally move to help. You don't have to legislate helpfulness or altruism or generosity. And so this presencing helps you be a better listener. I mean, everybody talks about relationships and, you know, so-and-so doesn't listen or men don't listen. Mindfulness, awarefulness, presencing is the antidote to this kind of problem. It's not just listening. People don't look. I mean, they're looking but not seeing because the awareness is distracted. And even if it's not intoxicated, which it often is today, it's kind of obscured by all the projections and imaginations and the past stuff that's on the windshield of your consciousness. The presencing helps us be more objective and present and clear. And when I'm clear, everything becomes clearer. That I can promise you. When you become clearer, everything becomes clearer. That's the secret of wisdom. That's the secret of developing wisdom, the wisdom of Solomon, the wisdom of Buddha in yourself. We all have this in us. But we need tools to become clearer, purify our body and refine our energy and open our chakras and channels and our heart and mind and body, nurture our body and soul and clarify our mind and become more free of our thoughts, not stop thinking, but be aware of thinking, be aware of hearing, be aware of seeing. Awareness is the higher power in the path of enlightenment, at least the Buddhist enlightenment. awareness is the active ingredient of meditation or presencing. That's how people wake up to who and what they truly are, find the Buddha or the divinity within, and not just within oneself, but within each of, and all of us.
And I guess that's what you were talking about when you were talking about entrainment or resonance, that when you put two people together, that they will begin to vibrate at the same rate or resonate, just like two clocks that you would put into the same room.
If your heart, if your attention, yeah, if your attention is there and your heart is there and your intention and attention is present, and presence, you know, and opening and caring, not just distracted or thinking about other things, wishing you weren't there. That so often is the case. Mm-hmm. Thinking about other things elsewhere, past or future.
Can you speak about the five perfections as a way to train our minds that every moment is perfect, every moment has we can access perfection?
Yes, I can see you've read Buddhist End Time very thoroughly for our... I appreciate that. It's very gratifying. The five perfections is a teaching of the Diamond Path or Vajrayana Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism. It doesn't really mean that, you know, there are no problems in the world or we don't get involved in social action. But what it means is to recognize that there's a lawful unfolding. There's a reason. Nothing happens by accident. There are causes. And therefore, to accept that and work with the situation as it is, that's a basic sanity or like basic goodness approach. This lawful unfolding, there's a reason. It's not a curse. It's not unfair. It's not somebody's fault. It's not because God decided it. You know, there's a whole karmic concatenation, a whole combination of causes. Why one would be sick or bad things would happen in a mall, terrible things in elementary school in Connecticut. And we have to deal with the origins and causes if we want to get different results. So the teaching of the five perfections helps us to come home to the here and now and realize this is the perfect place. This is the perfect place to be where we have to be, where we are, because we have to be here. Guess why? Because we are. What's the alternative? This is the perfect time. This is the perfect place. This is the perfect message or teaching, however you want to look at it. This is the perfect miracle or gift. Like the theists say, give thanks to God for everything. How do we know whether it's good or bad? We think it's a bad day if it rains, but maybe the farmers and the earthworms think it's a great day. Everything's so subjective or relative. And here's the hardest one of all to accept, the perfect student or the perfect recipient. You know, that you are the right person in the right place at the right time. That's the message. Now, we're not saying that it's great if you're in a car accident and you end up in the hospital. I mean, nobody wishes that in anybody. That would be insanity. Even with this difficult example, you know, if I'm in the hospital, I'm telling you that I say to myself, yes, I'm the perfect person to be here. I can take this and get those children out of here. I want to go and have their disease too. Better me than my nieces, nephews, and godchildren. So that's what we're talking about. Be the perfect person, the perfect place. And perfect doesn't mean as opposed to imperfect. We're not talking about like perfectionist. Just there's a rightness to this and owning and taking responsibility, being one with one's own karma. If you're a theist, you could say one with divine will, no problem. Mm-hmm. I don't know that one with karma is that different than one with divine will. It probably operates the same.
So it's to accept whatever arises and whatever our reality is?
Yeah, we're one with reality. We're in the flow. Congruent with reality, but it's not fatalist. We still can steer things, mm-hmm. but we're going with the flow on the river, but we can still use the rudder and set the sails and navigate. We don't have to just get blown away by the prevailing winds. So it's a balance, the middle way, as Buddha always called it, not too tight and not too loose, not too much and not too little. And I find that's a very key and helpful teaching for me about balance and appropriateness, mm-hmm. usually the middle way, not a fanatic moderation. Just don't end up in the ditches on either side. That's all I ask. Ditches such as gross nihilism, denying anything matters. On one side is a ditch. Or on the other side, gross materialism. Everything is just what it seems to be. It's so solid and real. And only things that can be weighed count. Gross materialism, equally dangerous. But there's a lot of in between on the spectrum. A lot of lanes. We don't have to be very square about this. But I think moderation and the middle way, balance, is really a great touchstone for me to chart my course and live my life very fulfillingly today and experience a lot of well-being no matter what happens to me, you know, and around me, health challenges or terrorism or whatever. Let's face it, there's a lot of shit in this world, but shit can also be manure and fertilizer. Shit, even shit is not that bad. Mm-hmm. Not that I wish that kind of terrorism and suffering anybody, but I'm just saying that the dark also, the shadows are nothing but light. That's very important to recognize in the bigger picture. That's the message of the five perfections. The shadows are nothing but light.
And that even the difficult realities of our life can elicit an enlightened response.
Yes. And I've written a whole book about this for our letting go of the person you used to be, spiritual growth and transformation through crisis and loss, or gaining through loss and the virtues of adversity. Sometimes when somebody leaves our relationship or we lose our job, it's the best thing that ever happened to us. Of course, we didn't want it to happen, but later we say, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. I never would have made that happen. I didn't want that to happen, but wow, it totally catapulted me into this new life. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize I was so stuck. So you never know. You never know. And of course, we wish well for others and we wish well for ourselves. But we do the best we can and let go. We love our children to death and we mother them, but we try not to smother them. That's too much. And we have to back them and let them go, get out of their way. And keep backing them and letting them go and get out of their way.
Now, one of the parts of the book that I had most difficulty grasping or understanding was when you spoke about bardo. And I know traditionally or classically it's considered the stage in between death and the next life, but you speak about it very differently in the book, and I still can't quite understand. I'm wondering if you can elaborate on it.
Well, I'm glad you asked about that, because before you were saying something about us being in between or a transition or something, mm-hmm. about mindfulness, and I can't remember how it came up, but I was thinking about the bardo, and I should mention that actually we're always in between, because we're in between something and something else. You know, everything is changing. Mm-hmm. It might look solid, but if you look with an electronic microscope, you see it's mostly space, and there's a few, you know, molecules and atoms and neutrons and electrons floating around, a few, you know, quarks and dorks and narcs, and, you know, there's a lot of space in there, and things are not as solid as they seem, but we're always in a bardo. So anyway, traditionally, the word bardo means the in-between or the intermediate stage, and people generally use it to refer to, this is Eastern thinking, the time after death and before rebirth, reincarnation. As Jews and Christians did until the 3rd or 4th century, when it was written out of the books at the Council of Nicaea in the year 436 or 346. But anyway, this is not that foreign to us. But now there's also the in-between, like in between birth and death is an in-between. The bardo of life, in which everything is changing, and you know how we guide ourselves through that is very important. Not just how we guide ourselves, you know, whether we go to, I hesitate to say, but in English, you have to use words like heaven or hell, you know, purgatory, whatever people think happen, mm-hmm. whatever general populace thinks happen after you die, you know, nothing or something, or, you know, people think about those things throughout history. So that's one bardo, but the bardo of life is another important bardo. There's also the in-between, like falling asleep, wake up in the morning, the bardo of sleep and dreams. Mm-hmm. And whether you guide it yourself in that, whether you have awareness in your dreams, like lucid dreaming, where you know you're asleep and dreaming even though you're asleep. Mm-hmm. You have some awareness, self-awareness that you can cultivate. Lucid dreaming, psychology calls it today. So Tibetan dream yoga, it's an over 1,000 years old practice of how to be awake in the dream and know you're dreaming and asleep and transform it into a very positive activity. So there's these different bardos, and there's the bardo of meditation from the time you sit down to the time you stand up. Again, how do you guide? Are you guided there or not? Or you just the mind just bounces around or what? See, all of these have this common thread. Are you guiding or trained, or is somebody guiding you from outside, or are you awareness guiding yourself in meditation, in dream, in the after death before birth stage, or even crucially in life? Mm-hmm. Are you just bouncing around like, what's it called, the bumper cars at the amusement park with a wheel, steering wheel isn't connected to the wheels, you know, in life? Were you like an animal just reacting in a moment to everything? Or do you have any like consciousness, you know, self-consciousness, self-awareness, awareness of future implications in time and space and others? Can you guide yourself? Do you have any mastery over your body, your energy, your mind, your psyche, your spirit, or not? So how you guide yourself during the bardo, the intermediate stage after birth and before death, is very important. Mm-hmm. So that's the theory about how to be guiding yourself. Sometimes it could be from someone else guiding you during these intermediate stages. The real point is that we're always in between things. Things are changing. They're not as solid. And so that's the moment of transformation.
Uh-huh.
We're not stuck. You see, because everything is impermanent, it might be insecure, but it's also freedom. You can make it of it. It's workable. So, karma is workable. It's conditioning. We're heavily conditioned, but we can also change the conditioning.
So every moment is a bardo. Every moment is a opportunity for awakening.
Right. Yes, that's the real point. Very good. If we go deeper into it, the bardo between one thought and another, it seems continuous. But if you're more aware, you know, like with a movie, it seems to be continuous.
Mm-hmm.
And but if you speed up the movie frame, it slows down what's happening because there's more frames per second or something. Maybe it's vice versa. I don't know. You know, if you get slow motion,
mm-hmm.
then like your mind can slow. When you're hyper conscious, I don't know. You probably never took any drugs, but I'm from the 60s, so we used to take drugs. And, you know, when your consciousness changes, the speed of your processing changes. So things could seem very slow, and then, you know, kind of like, I don't know, what's a break dancing or a slow-mo, you know. And then you see more details, or like a flower unfolding and things like that. So the consciousness changes. So you could, there's a bardo between each thought or each feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's freedom there. And in deep levels of meditation, you can get into that kind of consciousness.
Right.
Where there's no time, or it slows down, or you know, you have all the time in the world, or I don't know, infinite space, infinite time. You know, there are different subjective experiences. I mean, you can have mystical experiences, all kinds of things, if you practice these things. And this is ancient, timeless wisdom, yoga wisdom. You know, there's fasting, there's breath exercises, there's breath retention, you know, there's all kinds of things to do with sexual energy, with chanting, with visualization that changes your reality. You know, reality, so-called reality. And that's where the freedom is, because every moment's a bardo, as you so insightfully said. Every moment's a bardo. So one can almost choose, like, how you take it. You know, is this, like, a beautiful moment to say thank you, hallelujah for? Or the opposite.
Well, thank you so much for being with us here on Drishti Point, and for everything that you shared with us, both here on the phone and also in the book. And I definitely look forward to you coming to Vancouver, and look forward to rereading the book. Is there anything, any final comment you'd like to make for our listeners?
One thing that comes to mind, dear friends, is to say, if I can do it, you can do it. Anybody can do it. I'm just a Jewish jock from Long Island. I'm not the Dalai Lama. And, you know, I'm Jewish on my parents' side. I never heard of these things when I was growing up. Well, mystic Jewry, I never heard of Kabbalah or any of that until I was in India studying world religions as an adult. But the other thing I want to say is that the path is beneath your feet. Don't think it's somewhere else. Don't think you have to go far to find it. It's always accessible. It's up to intention and attention, and you know, it's in one's own heart. The God is hiding in the last place that we look, which is in one's own heart.
Well, that's a beautiful
word. And that's not an invitation to be more egotistical or narcissistic, but just hear me. Don't look too far afield for it. And moreover, seekers need to become finders one day. Become a finder, not just a seeker. And you can also find me on Twitter and Facebook and, you know, websites and my many books and YouTubes. And so let's awaken. Let's do this beautiful journey together.
Wonderful. That's a wonderful invitation to end with. Thank you so much for being with us on Drishti Point.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Drishti Point. We dedicate our efforts to the health and happiness of our listeners and for the health and happiness of all living beings.